Hey everybody, this is Tom Salemi, Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. We only have two episodes left before Device Talks Boston. I can't wait to see you all there. The numbers look great. Registrations are pouring in. We're really grateful. It's going to be a fantastic event. If you haven't yet registered, you still have time to do so, and actually have a little money-saving tip for you in just a moment. But thanks to everyone who's given the event a lot of buzz on LinkedIn. Thanks to one of our guests today. Coincidentally, by the way, I was going to have Scott Nelson of Fastwave on anyway, but today he posted a video. He had Jonathan Papelbon, former Red Sox great closer, do a little cameo thing, a little shout out to Device Talks. And frankly, I kind of lost my mind a little bit. I'm still such a baseball nerd. So thanks again to everyone who's giving it the buzz. And I really can't wait to see folks at the Boston Convention Exhibition Center on May 1st and 2nd, but also on April 30th, because on April 30th, we're going to have our opening reception, our opening networking reception, and that's where the special offer comes in. We are going to have Jeff Karp, who's a professor at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's at Harvard Medical School. He's going to go over his resume a little bit in the interview, but most recently, he just launched a book called LIT, which stands for Life Ignition Tools, and the title is Use Nature's Playbook to Energize Your Brain, Spark Ideas, and Ignite Action. So it's quite the appropriate book, and the timing is great because it just came out in April for Device Talks Boston, because we're going to talk a lot about innovation. We'll have our innovation forum there with MedTech Innovator, Innovate, Innovate, Innovate. So Jeff Karp will be there on April 30th at the opening reception. He'll have books for sale. He'll be signing books that are purchased. But you also have an opportunity to win some books. If you use the code LIT25, so it's LIT25, when you register, you'll save 25% off the price of Device Talks Boston. And the first 10 folks who do that will get a free book, and we'll give you the book at the conference. So I hope that you take this opportunity to register, to save some money, and to get a great book for yourself. Or, as I noted in the interview, it's graduation time. And for high school grads, college grads, this is a great way. It's not a science book. It's a book to sort of reset your brain and to open it up for new opportunities and ideas. So I think it's something we all could do and all could use. And I recommend that folks get it one way or the other, whether you try to get the free one, or whether you buy it at Device Talks Boston, or whether you just go on Amazon and order it. It's really a great read. And I actually used one of the tricks this morning, and I really found it helpful. So check it out. So we'll have Jeff Karp on first. I'll talk with him about the book and about his experiences. Then we'll have Scott Nelson on, my hero, who got Jonathan Papelbon to record a shout out to me and Device Talks, which was very, very cool. And he was at Fenway Park, but I'm gushing. I'll stop. And then a little later, we'll talk with Rebecca Seidel of Medtronic about pulse field ablation and about electrophysiology. So this episode is sponsored by Freudenberg Medical. Thank you to them for sponsoring Device Talks Weekly and a lot of our other great products. We had them on a Device Talks Tuesday just recently. So thanks to Freudenberg again for supporting Device Talks. So again, great episode for you. We'll be talking to Jeff Karp. We'll be hearing from Scott Nelson. And a little later, we'll be hearing from Rebecca Seidel of Medtronic. Once again, please don't miss out on Device Talks Boston. You only have a short amount of time to register and to attend, and we'd love to get your registrations in early so we know exactly what to prepare for. But it's on pace to be our biggest event ever. And as I've said ad nauseum, as a Boston guy, it's just a great thrill to put together this Boston event. And I really do think it's a can't miss event for MedTech. So go to boston.devicetalks.com to register. All right, let's get this podcast episode started. Remember, when you register, use the code LIT25, save 25% off. And the first 10 folks who do that get a free book from Jeff Karp called LIT, Life Ignition Tools. All right, now let's get this episode started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Well, Jeff Karp, welcome to the podcast.
So great to be back. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So we've got a really cool topic to talk about. We'll be talking about innovation a great deal at Device Talks Boston, which is, of course, coming up in just a couple of weeks. And so it was really timely that I happened upon your book, which is called LIT, and it stands for Life Ignition Tools. And it seemed like kismet that these would come together at the same time. So I'm happy to discuss this book. I want to pull a few of the gold nuggets out of here, but also wanted to remind folks, in case they missed it up at the top of the podcast, that you'll be at Device Talks Boston. You'll be at our opening reception on April 30th, and copies of this book will be available. So hopefully folks will feel as inspired as I was. So thank you for being part of Device Talks Boston.
Hey, thanks for the opportunity.
So let's talk about first a little bit about you. Talk about your lab and some of the projects you worked on. People know you, of course, by name, and your keynote and TED Talks and all that. But just give folks a little bit of a primer on Jeff Karp and your lab.
Absolutely. So my laboratory is focused on the process of medical innovation, and really in the broadest sense, I see it as a continually evolving, iterative process that we're developing in the lab that we're now applying to all kinds of different problems across the industry. And in particular, you know, unlike sort of traditional academia, where the goal is to publish papers, our goal is to choose projects and really align projects and keep them aligned the whole distance, so that we maximize potential to create new therapies, diagnostics, and other types of tools that could, you know, quickly be brought to patients. So some of the things that we've worked on include a surgical glue that we demonstrated could seal holes inside a beating heart and seal blood vessels. I co-founded a company a number of years ago called Tissium. It's based in Paris. And that company received regulatory approval for vascular reconstruction in Europe using this tissue glue.
Wow.
The glue actually is biodegradable, and it's elastic, also light curable, and we can tune the degradation of this material. It actually sort of infiltrates into the tissue, and then when we shine light onto it, light can go in, you know, tens of microns, 100 microns or so, and cure the material inside the tissue. So it's almost like a tissue-like kind of Velcro interlock. And we're currently exploring this in a couple of clinical trials in Australia, one for nerve reconstruction and another for hernia repair. So that's, you know, one example that from the lab. We've also developed needles that can automatically stop in different layers of the eye to deliver gene therapy to the back of the eye to treat macular degeneration. So that's in the process of being advanced towards a trial. Company Myra Therapeutics has a gene therapy, and they acquired a company that I co-founded, Bullseye Therapeutics, that had the needle, and you know they're moving that forward. Also been working on a lot of different ways to deliver drugs to the body, including nanoparticles to target the brain for various neurological conditions and traumatic brain injury. We're also developing drug delivery systems to treat osteoarthritis and cancer.
So you've got a resume. We'll say that. I'm just curious. Do you see? I mean, your lab is, and your success is based on science, but innovation itself, is innovation a science or an art or a mixture of both in your mind?
I think innovation is really a mixture of both. I think there's just so many insights that we can gain along the way, and the insights can help us to update that process. So I really, really see innovation as process driven and just many, many different considerations. So for example, let's say if you know, typically in academia, if we're thinking of a problem, you know, we might think of the biology problem, you know, what's the target, or we might think of sort of the medical problem, you know, what's the tissue's torn, it needs to be, you know, put back together, and you know, we sort of think of it like that. What does the surgeon need to do? to get the patient, you know, kind of on their way. But I think for innovation really to happen, we have to think broader than that. We need to think about, you know, some of the translational aspects, including the patent problem. You know, if we can't get a patent, then we're unlikely to get investment or partnership, you know, with the companies that we need to partner with to really gain the momentum. We also have to think about the clinical trial problem early in the process. So, you know, what are we going to compare to if this goes to a trial? And ideally, we want that to be part of our experiments early on as a way to define if we're on the right track, can kind of help us to determine if our results are important. And then there's the manufacturing problem as well. You know, a lot of technologies coming out of bioengineering or biomedical labs just haven't made it to patients because you can't manufacture it. And then, you know, there's the reimbursement problem and the practical application. And so I kind of see innovation as really almost like a Venn diagram, like overlapping circles, and all these domains, you really need to find the overlap. And in my lab, I've just found it incredibly useful to think about all of these right at the start and along, you know, the entire process. And I think it really helps to define a North Star for projects to keep us on track towards maximizing potential to you know, to truly innovate.
That's great. No, it's a great way to put it. Almost sounds like innovation sort of is the first gear to get you moving forward, but all those other sciences and things are second, third, and fourth and fifth gears to really really get you to take off. So let's talk about the book, because LIT, I think it's, and it's, again, it stands for Life Ignition Tools, and for me it really kind of seems it read as sort of a how-to for innovating new ideas, not so much, you know, get a whiteboard, write things down, but more how to appreciate what's inside you and what's outside in the world and sort of connect the two to generate new ideas. How did you come to write this book, LIT? What was the inspiration behind writing a book about inspiration?
Yeah, well, an agent contacted me in New York, you know, 7-8 years ago. She had seen some of the work that we had published on bioinspiration, where we turned to nature for inspiration, you know, to bring fresh ideas into the lab and really to try to get our brains into this high energy brain state, you know, where we do our best thinking. And I was really interested in writing a book on that topic, but there was something else that was really burning within me, which is when I was younger, I struggled a lot with undiagnosed ADHD and learning differences. And I really had to, for survival, develop tools that were, you know, coping mechanisms. And then eventually I turned those survival tools into tools to thrive and really to become more efficient and productive, but then also to find ways to use the tools to maximize connection with people, which has been incredibly helpful in my lab to, you know, I really try to create an environment to empower people, because I think it just creates maximal optimism and really momentum in the most, you know, massive way possible. And as well, you know, I commit to being a mentor for life for everybody who enters my lab. So LIT, the tools really came out not from my laboratory per se, but really from my life's laboratory. And I've been using them for both professional and personal development.
So how did you decide to lay out the book or to write the book? It's written very much kind of in a, each chapter is more or less a lesson or a step. Did you want it to be read that, obviously if you wrote it that way, you want it to be read that way, but, but do you want this to be sort of a how-to for folks? How do you describe this book to someone if you're talking with them in someone's backyard at a barbecue?
Well, you're exactly right. Each chapter is a tool. There are 12 tools altogether, and they're really simple set of holistic tools that, you know, you can either use one at a time, or, you know, they work also together in kind of like a symphony. And the tools are designed to help us tap into a heightened state of awareness that we can bring to any moment or any situation and really to infuse fresh energy into our lives so that we can really take those steps forward to be intentional and be deliberate and really identify, you know, what are the high value questions, for example, that we should be asking that can really lead us towards maximal impact. So for example, one of the chapters is called Live for the Questions, and it's all about how we need a tool to fire up our neurons and our thinking and really help us to identify what's the best next step forward, and to also help us identify what's the most important thing to focus on. So for example, in the laboratory, one of the questions that I ask in every lab meeting is the following: what is the bar we need to exceed to get everybody excited? In other words, it's kind of like the so what question.
Mm-hmm.
It's what's the best result that anyone has ever achieved in a particular model, and how much better do we need to do to really claim that we've moved the needle for the field? And to me, it's just such an important question to ask, because it really helps us to focus our attention on impact.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do that, you know, when we go to submit our work to journals, it becomes much more easy to communicate the impact of what we've achieved, or when we go present at conferences. But then also when we go talk to investors, or, you know, we're trying to build an entrepreneurial team, the better we can convey the impact of what we've achieved, you know, the more likely we are to gain momentum and really, you know, move things forward in a major day. So questions are just so important, I think, in every area of our life. And we can even, you know, turn within to ask ourselves high value questions that can help us to identify roadblocks in maybe our thinking, or to help us to reframe things so that we can make sense of certain situations and get ourselves out of ruts, or, you know, sometimes we get hung up on certain things, and questions can help us get out of those ruts and on our way.
That's interesting. I mean, we I think we usually see or often see innovation as sort of an incremental crawl towards something, and you start here and you figure out how to take the next step and the next rock. To me, it sounds as if you're sort of inverting that and saying, this is where we want to be. Set the destination first, and then trust that you're going to find each rock to get to that point that you've already identified.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. So I think that, you know, there certainly is, it's kind of like anything we do, let's say in the laboratory, there's certain elements of process that we have used previously that we can apply, but there's also a whole realm of new possibilities, new ways that we need to think about things. You know, every project is completely different. And I think what really defines whether we're successful or, you know, can create momentum is really based on the questions we ask, or the questions that we don't ask. And in fact, I'll give you a story. When I started my laboratory, one of the first technologies that we developed was to take stem cells out of the body and manipulate them, modify them so that we could infuse them into the bloodstream, just, you know, simple intravenous infusion, and have them target any site. So you can imagine, you know, we might be able to treat, if we could target stem cells to the bone and have them produce new bone, you know, we could treat osteoporosis. Or if we could target stem cells to the heart following a heart attack, we might be able to prevent the progression to heart failure.
Mm-hmm.
Or if we could target stem cells to the brain, you know, there's a whole variety of neurological conditions. And we were literally on the cusp of a major breakthrough. We had data demonstrating that we could actually do this. We could take stem cells out, manipulate them, and infuse them to target specific sites in the body. And I was so excited about this. I went to Flagship Ventures and to present. And, you know, I was certain that this was going to be a company, and you know, we'd be on our way. And, you know, it was one of these things where I couldn't sleep the night before. I was just so excited. I get in the next day, and I'm just really into it. I go through all the data. I'm almost like smirking because I just feel like I got this in the bag. And Nubar, the head of Flagship, reaches over and he says, "Jeff, this is really, really great, but we're going to take a pass." And I was like, "What?" And it was like one of those moments where I couldn't really hear too much of what he was saying next, but he essentially said to me that what we were doing was just too complicated and that it was like a five-step process and we would need quality control at every step. And so even though, the data was great, the process we had used was just far too complex and would create too much manufacturing risk. And so I went back to the lab, and initially was really, really frustrated and kind of angry because this was, I just started my lab and this was the first major project. I'd worked about a year and a half on it and, pretty much put all my resources into it. But as what happens, kind of typically after a challenge or a failure, the emotions subside after a day or two, kind of like one of these after the rain moments, and the insight started to pour in, and I realized that, wait a moment, here I am at the beginning of my career, and I could apply the insights that I just gained from the question I failed to ask, which is what happens next after something leaves the lab. Through this process, this concept of radical simplicity was born, which I really see as the art and discipline of minimizing complexity at all levels. And since that time, I've applied it to every project in the lab. And I think it's one of the reasons why pretty much every major project in the lab has turned into a company.
That's fascinating. So again, turning to the book LIT, it stands for Life Ignition Tools, and it's out and it's available. You talk a lot about your connection to nature and how that inspires innovation, or at least puts you in a place where innovation can occur. Can you expand on that a bit?
Absolutely. So, nature is just so incredible. I mean, so multifaceted, and there's just so much that we can learn from nature. And I think that, through one lens, when we look at nature, it's the environment is constantly changing. There's perturbations. There's forest fires or meteors or volcanoes or there's all trees that are falling down, and yet nature or weather changes, and nature is experimenting constantly, and adapting. And I think that there's a lot that we can learn from that. And then even a layer deeper is that everything in nature is interconnected. So for example, there's sub-millimeter creatures in the ocean, the phytoplankton, which are providing over half of the oxygen that we breathe on Earth. And it's not from the trees, it's actually from the phytoplankton in the ocean. And so just as we start to understand the interconnectedness of everything, we start to realize that our dependence on this interconnectedness, this interdependence, and I think nature really thrives on biodiversity. And to me, so I've learned so many lessons from nature that have helped me to really construct my lab in a way to maximize our ability to achieve impact. And so one of the things that we do in the lab is minimize the overlap of expertise of people, so maximize the diversity of people in the lab. And it's not just to maximize diversity for the sake of it. It literally leads to different ways of thinking, different accesses, like different access to tools and knowledge. So, for example, we have in the lab at any given time chemical engineers, mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, immunologists, basic biologists. We've had a gastrointestinal surgeon, a cardiac surgeon. We've had a dentist. and it's constantly changing. And so by minimizing the overlap, we're actually maximizing our potential to have access to, you know, reach into all kinds of different fields, the tools, the knowledge, the ways of thinking. And then we've had people from over 30 countries in the lab as well. And, you know, the education system is different in every country. And so people think a little bit differently. And I think that's also, you know, one of the reasons why we're able to, you know, make advances the way that we have. The other thing about nature is that I think nature doesn't have an end goal. Nature is just constantly evolving and adapting. And when we think of the human kind of condition and how we lead our lives, we often set these goals and they feel like the end. You know, if we don't achieve the goal, we you know, can get quite upset about it. And so this is also something that I think is really critical to consider as we advance in various projects, is that sort of like the iterative nature of nature and you know, how we can actually bring that into our projects and really see that the goal is really gaining insights and improving over time. I'll just give you an example. Recently, I got invited to give a talk at an innovation course at Stanford, you know, about 6 weeks ago or so. And I'd never given a talk on the book before. And so I went and I, you know, I prepared the talk, used all the processes that I have developed over the years for putting, you know, lectures together. And I went out there and I gave it, and, you know, I think it went well. It was okay. But, you know, it wasn't like I didn't hit it out of the park, right? Mm-hmm. And but instead of sort of just jumping to self-shame like I would do, let's say, in the past, I was able to sort of say to myself, you know what, this is just generation 1.0. And there probably is going to be like a generation 5 and a generation 10 and maybe even a generation 20. And so I kind of was able to focus my attention on the iterative kind of improvements and sort of notice parts of that lecture where I maybe wasn't connecting the way I wanted to. And so on the flight back, you know, I was able to make some tweaks to the slides, which then ends up being exciting because I know I'm going to be able to connect even more the next time I give that lecture.
Interesting. So one other area I wanted to get into in the book, and again, the name of the book is Lit, and I think it's timely that it's coming out now. I think it's probably a great gift for graduates, high school graduates, college graduates. It seems like that kind of book that helps folks set a path. In the book, and you've talked about this before, but in the book you reference your childhood and your learning differences and how that sort of led to you building this career. Talk a bit about we don't need to cover your childhood in great detail, but what were some of the different approaches you had to learning as a child, and how has it helped you reach where you are? And again, folks can read about this also in the book.
One of the greatest lessons that I learned as a child, as I was sort of navigating, you know, these learning differences in ADHD, was just how powerful attention is. And, you know, here this like super distracted kid, you know, I remember one day I actually got off the bus. I think it was in the third grade. We had just moved out into the country, and my driveway was, you know, it's carved through a forest. And I was walking along the driveway and I saw a bat, and I had never seen a bat before. And it just amazed me how, you know, I would have almost be ruminating after I got off the bus of all the challenges that I kind of, you know, was just tired, exhausted, and just all these different thoughts in my mind. And when I saw this bat, it was almost like it squeezed out all the other thoughts. I could only focus on the bat. And later on, in the evening, I started thinking like, maybe I could bring this concept or this sort of power of being able to pinch out other thoughts from my brain, so that I could focus on learning in school, because I found it very difficult to kind of follow along. And so I learned to be able to pinch my brain, to actually squeeze out other thoughts and essentially use my intention to focus my attention. And this is something that I've been doing kind of throughout life as a way to really maximize not just the information that is kind of processing in my mind, but also imprinting into my memory, and then being able to recall it later and connect ideas and do lateral thinking, which is where I think a lot of the kind of creative, problem solving and brainstorming, tends to happen. And I think that, all of us are capable of pinching our brains in this way and really refining our attention. It's our greatest resource, I think. And especially important in this digital age where we have all these algorithms and $900 billion of marketing and advertising every year that is going into hijacking our attention. So I think it's really important that we have ways and tools to develop our this skill of focusing our attention on the things that, and you're really being deliberate about it.
Is there a hack you can share? I know I at the end of the day, I find myself particularly. I have a hard time concentrating. I'll put some music on and it kind of focuses my brain a bit and I'm able to get some work done. Is there anything you do in particular to give your brain a squeeze?
Absolutely, absolutely. So one of the things that I do, and I've kind of found that there's a variety of things I can do during the day that are deceptively simple, but if I kind of make a practice out of it, it really helps to rewire my brain. In fact, it's important, I think, for everyone to consider that we have this incredible prefrontal cortex in our brain. Relative to the brain size, I think it's the largest in of all the animals. And then we also have, and that's where executive function is, where we're consciously focusing our attention and problem solving and planning and thinking about thinking. And then we have this incredible ability to rewire our brains, neuroplasticity. And so I think if we can find practices like the one I'm going to tell you in a moment, there's lots of them, lots of possibilities, and just kind of try to go back to it every day, once or twice, we can start to use our prefrontal cortex to rewire our brains, and then our attention improves. And so one of the really, really simple ways of doing this is really to tune into specific senses that we have. Our senses are how we experience the world. And our digital culture and the algorithms and all this advertising, it really flattens our senses. And so there's, I think, a goal of kind of resensitizing them. And so one of the things I do is at least one meal a day, if not all of them, I will really tune into the flavors and make that the intention. And so if I'm eating, there's a tendency these days, I think, to have your phone and you're kind of scrolling, you're watching Netflix or whatever. And if you're doing that, your attention's really atomized because you're multitasking. And so if you kind of set the intention to connect with the flavors in a meal, then you're, moving away from multitasking and you're really sort of honing in on and laser focusing on a single sense. And so I found that to actually be really useful. And in fact, you can even before you eat, you can even like pause just for a moment to consider what the flavors might like, what the taste of everything might be of what you're about to eat. And that's another way, again, of sort of rewiring your brain to focus your attention on these specific senses. And to take that one step further, another really simple thing, and I think, again, deceptively simple thing that we can do to improve our attention is as we walk outside, for example, we can cycle through our senses. So what I mean by that is we can walk around our neighborhoods and say, for example, I do this all the time, I say sight, and I'll look at the texture of the bark on the trees, and I'll look at the tops of the trees. And I'll look at the clouds, and then I'll say hearing, and I'll just listen for the birds, and I'll listen for the rustling of the wind in the leaves, or and then I'll say touch, and I'll feel my heels hit the ground and my toes, and I'll feel the clothes against my skin and the wind hit my face. And essentially, what I'm doing is resensitizing my senses by focusing individually on each one, one at a time. And these simple practices have really helped me to focus my attention. Another simple thing I do as well is, let's say if I'm driving in the car, there's a tendency for me to just turn on the radio, put on a podcast. I just almost just instantaneously, habitually just reach for the button,
Well, I'm glad
and
as a podcaster, I think you should. I think I'm going to cut this part of the interview up. No, I'm just kidding. Continue.
So what I do from time to time is I just pause, like I press pause. And I just sort of see what happens. And what typically will happen is if I press pause, that sensation kind of fades, but then it comes back, like a minute later. And it's like I feel the urge, I gotta listen to something. And then I let that sort of dissipate again. And then it happens again. And what I found is about three times, if I can resist sort of that impulse, like just by pressing pause, then I eventually become comfortable with just my own thoughts and sort of looking out the window and paying attention to driving. And again, I feel like that's to me what intentionality is all about. It's about these little things in our day where we can focus our attention and be very deliberate about it. And by making a practice of that, we're able to rewire our brains and be able to, then use that as a tool to pay attention to anything that we want.
That's fantastic. Nope, I think that's great advice. I think it's a great tease of what's in the book. Again, the book is called Lit, that stands for Life Ignition Tools. Use nature's playbook to energize your brain, spark ideas, and ignite action.
Yes.
So we'll have you at Device Talks Boston again. You'll be at the opening reception, which is happening on April 30th from 5 to 7. We'll have a table set up where folks can buy this book. But as I said up top, folks who use the code that we gave, the first 10 will get a book for free, and folks can buy copies there as well. And I imagine you'll be signing if people ask.
Absolutely. Be happy to.
I think it would be a great commencement gift, graduation gift for someone. Lots of what I really liked about it is you read it and it's very familiar. It's almost intuitive. You're like, oh, that I could do that, and I could do that, and I could do that. I think it's very approachable. And very helpful. So well done. Very nice book. Thanks for putting that together.
Hey, thank you. Thanks again for having me on your show, and I've enjoyed this conversation.
Me too. We'll see you at Device Talks Boston. Stop recording. All right, great. It was a great conversation with Jeff Karp. Really looking forward to having him at Device Talks Boston's opening reception. Make sure you register using the code LIT25. You'll not only save 25%, which is almost a couple hundred bucks, but you also get a free copy of Lit signed by Jeff Karp himself. And he'll be there to share stories, to talk about the book, to talk about other things that he's working on, which are a lot of amazing things, as you heard. So a great opportunity to meet one of Biomed's better innovators. So with that, I'd like to bring in our podcast sponsor, Freudenberg Medical. I'm speaking with Paul Weifer. Paul is the Director of Product Development at Freudenberg Medical. Paul, welcome. Tell us about Freudenberg Medical, and we're going to be talking a lot about electrophysiology. Talk about what you do in the space.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Thanks for the introduction. And I'm delighted to be joining you and your listeners on today's podcast. So at Freudenberg Medical, we are a global partner to medical device OEMs for product design, development, and manufacturing. This includes medical components and tubing to drug and device solutions and finished devices. We have 11 locations worldwide located in all the key medtech clusters globally. We've been supporting leading players in the EP devices market for over 15 years at this point, partnering on a range of product solutions from steerable access devices through to ablation and visualization catheters. Our specific design and volume manufacturing capabilities for the EP market is supported from 5 of our sites in 3 continents with a combined footprint of now over 400,000 square feet. And we are obviously very proud to be a trusted outsourcing partner to our customers for their EP product portfolios.
That's really fascinating, Paul. So what are some of the unique design and manufacturing challenges associated with EP devices?
Well, Tom, I think there are two that come to mind. Firstly, catheter steering. So in EP procedures, we're navigating the intricate left side of the heart, which is a constantly dynamic 3D structure. So for physicians and engineers alike, precision steering is essential. We're strategizing how to maneuver through the atrium, avoid delicate structures, and prevent catheter misplacement for the best patient outcome. This is where multiplanar catheter and handle steering mechanisms and their associated design nuances step in. The second key challenge is probably around real estate management within the catheter. So for context, most EP catheters are about half the diameter of a ballpoint pen, yet we're cramming them with more and more technology now. Alongside steering mechanisms, we could be incorporating energy delivery systems, sensors, optics, and irrigation functions. The question is, how do we fit this all in? One main answer lies in cutting-edge design for manufacturing. Take, for instance, the shift in cable management from individual electrode wires to flexible PCBs and flex circuits along the catheter shaft. This not only streamlines the assembly process, but also enhances performance and reliability. So in essence, Tom, I feel the catheter engineering community is rising to the occasion with remarkable ingenuity and incremental innovations. And despite the unique challenges, we're continuously pushing boundaries with our customers to revolutionize patient care.
All right, we'll hear more from Paul Weifer a little later in the podcast. If you want to find out more about Freudenberg Medical, go to its website, freudenbergmedical.com. And Freudenberg is spelled F-R-E-U-D-E-N-B-E-R-G, freudenbergmedical.com. Next up, I'd like to give a little bit of preview of who will be speaking at Device Talks Boston. In this next clip, it's a conversation I had with Scott Nelson, who's the CEO of Fastwave, which is one of the intravascular lithotripsy companies that we'll be talking to. Of course, Shockwave sort of created this space, or at least created the application that they're using. They're being acquired by J&J. We'll see how that turns out. And that's going to leave a couple of companies, at least in this space. One of them will be Fastwave. The other one will be AVS, Amplitude Vascular Systems, and both will be at Device Talks Boston, and I'll be leading a conversation with Scott Nelson and Sean Gilligan of AVS. So I spoke with Sean about 2 months ago, so this is just a quick overview of Fastwave. We, of course, had him on the podcast a few months ago, but just wanted to give him a chance to, again, tell Fastwave's story and give a little preview of what's coming up at Device Talks Boston. Let's listen. Hey, everybody. Tom Salemi here from Device Talks. We're talking about our agenda at Device Talks Boston, which is happening on May 1st and 2nd at the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center. I'm really enjoying the opportunity to meet with some of our speakers prior to the meeting and to help them share their stories with you. And I'm particularly happy to have Scott Nelson, the CEO of Fastwave Medical, here today. Scott, thanks for joining us in this discussion.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom. Really looking forward to this chat, but also Device Talks come early May.
No, I love Device Talks Boston and Device Talks West, of course, but Device Talks Boston is my hometown conference. But what I like about MedTech and I like about Device Talks is we try to really identify the problems in the healthcare industry that MedTech folks are trying to solve. And the MedTech industry is all about targeting those problems, those bottlenecks, those weak spots in the industry, and creating new devices to solve them and to treat patients and to streamline the operation. So I'll get off my soapbox to talk about Fastwave, but the whole topic excites me. So what is the particular problem that Fastwave Medical is trying to solve?
Yeah, we're designing and developing intravascular lithotripsy systems. So the acronym that's often used, at least within the cardiovascular space, is IVL. And so the best sort of analogy that I often like to kind of refer to is plumbing, right? So most of those folks that are listening to this have probably dealt with some sort of blockage in a pipe. In some cases, Drano, simple Drano will work. In other cases, the blockage is too severe, too complex, and you need to call in a plumber. And in sort of the plumbers in our case are interventional cardiologists and vascular surgeons, and oftentimes they're utilizing a tool set, right? A tool bag of various modalities. Some of those include angioplasty, stents, I think, or scaffolding is probably the best way to think of stents, and atherectomy is another kind of technology as well. But IVL is part of that tool bag, right? And it's a newer category kind of in the space, but has proven to be especially useful when treating complex blockages or complex calcium, whether it's in the legs or in the heart.
Interesting. So IVL is a space that was developed by a startup. It's a true startup story. Shockwave developed it, developed the IVL system. So they're out there in the market now. What is Fastwave doing that's a bit different? What is the solution that you're bringing to this problem?
Yeah, and to your point, Shockwave has done an incredible job, right, in creating this category, right, applying or taking technology that we've known for decades and extracorporeal lithotripsy for kidney stones and sort of applying that inside angioplasty balloons. And so they've done a phenomenal job of not only creating the category, but executing commercially. That said, there's some kind of some clear gaps that a lot of physicians would like to see addressed. Maybe even kind of, you know, zooming out a little bit, a lot of physicians just want to see more options, more IVL options to choose from. And so some of those gaps that we're trying to solve for with Fastwave and the systems that we're developing are longer length balloons, right, to treat long diffuse disease, balloons that are a little bit more crossable and easier to traverse and navigate through complex calcium. In addition, oftentimes physicians that are treating heavily diseased vessels want more energy pulses to work with. And so that's another area that we're focused on at Fastwave.
Interesting. So where is Fastwave in your development? And how do you, as a startup, medtech is all about startups taking on bigger challenges. Maybe there's already players in the space, as there is in this case. What's Fastwave's plans for the next couple of years? And how do you see yourself engaging in the market?
Yeah. We're a reasonably young company, right? I mean, we started the company officially formed in early 21. Have made some pretty nice progress since then. So raised almost $20 million to date. We've got a number of patents under our belts and have moved quite rapidly, I would say. And actually just recently completed our first in human studies in the periphery and are now focused on moving forward into pivotal trials in the periphery and then early stage clinical work in the coronaries as well. So one of the things that we're trying to optimize for at Fastwave is obviously not only addressing some of the gaps that I mentioned previously, but also executing against those quickly and efficiently and in a fast, pun intended, fast sort of fashion. And so that's one of the things that probably sets us apart as a company.
Fantastic. Well, I'm looking forward to having your story told at Device Talks Boston. You'll be on a panel on IVL. And I'm really grateful you took a few minutes today to share your story and to be part of this conversation.
Yeah, appreciate the opportunity. Thanks again, Tom. And really looking forward to Device Talks Boston in early May.
All right, it was great to talk to Scott Nelson of Fastwave. Once again, he'll be on a panel that I'm moderating on May 1st at Device Talks Boston. Go to boston.devicetalks.com to register and to check out the agenda. Now we'll bring back our sponsor, Freudenberg Medical. Once again, I'm here with Paul Weifer. Paul is Director of Product Development at Freudenberg Medical. Paul, we're going to be talking about pulsed field ablation a little more in this podcast episode. Can you tell me about your experiences so far in pulse field ablation?
Yes, well, the race is very evident, Tom. As your listeners will know, all the large EP players are highly active with multiple PFA designs in the mix, some already successfully on the market. Add to that the estimated dozen or more small and mid-sized companies also eyeing the PFA opportunity. So certainly it makes for an exciting and competitive landscape. That said, we see many of these players looking to specialist external partners like Freudenberg Medical to accelerate the pace of catheter development and, more crucially, provide turnkey ability to scale manufacturing of these catheters to high volume. There is a keen focus on reliability, previous experience with PFA catheters, and the ability of the partner to always hit critical timelines. And it's important to note, it's not just about the PFA catheters that are the focus of development. There are complementary enabling devices for access, steering, and visualization, which must also be considered. Freudenberg Medical is proud to be an active partner in PFA and equally as proud of the contribution we have made so far to help pioneering customers claim firsts in the market.
Great stuff, Paul Weifer. We'll have Paul Weifer, Freudenberg Medical, back a little later in this podcast episode. Once again, if you'd like to find out more information about the company, go to its website, freudenbergmedical.com. Now let's listen to the conversation I had with Rebecca Seidel. She's president of Cardiac Ablation Solutions at Medtronic. Well, Rebecca Seidel, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Tom. Great to see you again.
Great to see you as well. You were one of our original guests on the Medtronic Talks podcast, so we're welcoming you back in a way, but this is your first time, I think, on our Device Talks Weekly podcast, so great to have you.
Indeed. Thank you.
And a great topic, too. So much going on. So I don't think we got into a little bit on the Medtronic Talks podcast, but since it's a separate podcast, let's take it from the top. What's your path into the medtech industry? How'd you find your way?
Yeah, so I started as an electrical engineer a million years ago, and you know that's really how I got interested in the science. When I came over to Medtronic, I started in a customer service area, which is an exciting place to be for certain, but I quickly fell in love with electrophysiology and have had a few different roles in that space, but it's super exciting. It's one of those places that continues to innovate over and over, and I think because, you know, atrial fibrillation is a progressive disease, there's always more to do and more to think about to make it a better treatment for patients.
And what was your first job in medtech?
Yeah, my first job in medtech was actually on a customer service line and also installing systems. And so a field service type job where I think I learned a lot from physicians and learned a lot from, you know, what we did right and what we did wrong and how we could really delight or, you know, sometimes disappoint. And so that that really resonated with me that what we do and when we get things right, it really, really matters for patients.
And you mentioned your love of electrophysiology. It is an intriguing field. What is it about what are the qualities of electrophysiology that really appeal to you?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about electrophysiology is the science that's necessary in order to really think about how do you treat a patient. So, as I said, it's a progressive disease, and you know what fits for one patient may not fit for all patients. So, the conversations that we have with physicians, the way we continue to innovate is what's really exciting to me.
Excellent. So let's talk about pulse field ablation, which is what is the talk of the day. Medtronic was one of the first product approved by the FDA. We can get into those particulars in a moment. But if you wouldn't just taking a moment and just giving us an understanding of what pulse field ablation is and how it differs from other ablative technologies.
Yeah, so pulse field ablation is really the third energy source in the mix for AF ablation. So we've had cryotechnology, RF technology, and now pulse field ablation. The interesting thing about pulse field ablation is it really has selective tissue capability. And so what that means is when you're only ablating cardiac myocytes, you may not ablate other tissues around, so esophagus or other things that could cause complications. And I think that's the real excitement and enthusiasm about this technology. It could be safer, and all the evidence is showing that it will be safer, and it could be even faster. So those are the things that make it really interesting and exciting.
How is it able to affect some tissue but not others?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think, you know, primarily because of the waveform that we're using with pulse field ablation, it has the sensitivity to really just go after cardiac myocytes. Every single company has a different waveform that they're using for pulse field ablation. So one PFA, maybe just one PFA, and we're working to fine tune those waveforms in order to ensure we get the best result.
And we'll take a quick break from this conversation for one final visit from our friends at Freudenberg Medical. Once again, I am speaking with Paul Weaver. Paul's the Director of Product Development at Freudenberg Medical. Paul, as an outsourcing partner, do you see any new or additional challenges in pulse field ablation devices over and above, say, the traditional RF or cryoablation designs?
Well, that's an interesting question, Tom. If I reflect on first generation PFA devices, we are seeing a blend of built for purpose and repurposed designs. So I think as we transition into the next phase, we anticipate a shift towards more purpose-built designs, which will undoubtedly introduce fresh design opportunities and complexities. So from the perspective of a catheter engineer, as we work through these second generation devices, the evidence of real-world data will be instrumental in guiding future design trajectories in PFA. I believe establishing gold standards, particularly regarding energy delivery techniques, such as single-shot, focal, or point-by-point approaches, the shape of the electrical field and waveform, all of these factors will be pivotal. the nuances between unipolar and bipolar energy delivery, and the necessity for mapping remains an open question. So it wouldn't surprise me, Tom, to witness the eventual dominance of a hybrid device, amalgamating various energy modalities or mapping techniques into a single device, potentially packing even more technology into the one catheter. So while we do this, we also need to figure out how do we keep sheet profiles low for easy handling and maneuverability. I believe as PFA matures, it will certainly present novel challenges, as is typical of any emerging therapy. But at Freudenberg Medical, working with our customers, we are relishing and embracing these challenges head on.
All right, Paul, a final question, a little bit of a challenging one. If you had to condense your experiences with PFA so far into just three words, what would those three words be?
Great question, Tom. I think the first would be excitement, second, pace, and the third, expertise. So excitement because of the transformative potential that PFA holds. In a lot of ways, it's akin to the excitement surrounding breakthroughs like drug-eluting stents and TAVI. PFA is a new kid on the block, which is getting a lot of attention, so there's excitement when you are contributing to that. We know pace is crucial in this highly competitive race to the market, and everyone aims for that first mover advantage, but obviously not everyone can attain it. And finally, expertise is essential. In this fast evolving field, outsourced partners must offer unparalleled EP credentials and a strong track record if they are to guide a customer's program on a successful and streamlined path to market.
All right, that's great stuff. Thank you, Paul Weifer, for joining us on this podcast episode. Thank you, Freudenberg, for sponsoring this episode. Once again, if you'd like to find out more information about Freudenberg Medical, go to its website, FreudenbergMedical.com. That's FreudenbergMedical.com. So let's talk about your pipeline. Let's start with Pulse Field Select. Give us a sense of your offerings, and then we can sort of move into some of the newer additions centered around pulse field ablation.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're really proud to have the first pulse field ablation technology approved in the U.S. market, and that is the Pulse Select technology. This particular technology has been built from the ground up in order to really suit pulse field ablation for patients. I would say that we built this product internally. We also have an external product called Affera that we acquired. But if you go back to pulse field ablation and Pulse Select, we spent about 10 to 15 years really working on the basic science of pulse field ablation, learning about hemolysis, learning about the proper waveform, learning about safety features. And the team's really, really proud of that work we've done over the last 10 to 15 years. Mark Stewart, who was our key scientist on this technology, had the really key paper that was acknowledged by HRS around the basics of pulse field ablation. So that's where we started. We also decided that because that technology is a PVI technology, that we also needed a focal catheter, and that's why we purchased the Affera system. So that system was purchased, you know, more than a year ago. It's on market in Europe, and it's getting really, really strong positive feedback for a focal wide area footprint catheter included with a mapping system. So it's unique. It's a catheter that delivers pulse field ablation, it delivers RF, and it's a mapping catheter as well. So it's super unique and differentiated in the market.
What's the function of the mapping catheter? What does it actually map? What is it doing?
Yeah, so the mapping catheter allows the physician to see where you are in the heart and where signals are in the heart. So it gives them basically the guidance that they need to go and ablate a patient where they want to and when they want to. So it's really their roadmap.
Okay. Interesting. So the acquisition, as you said, was a year ago. So this is now what the Sphere 360 is?
So it's
that's that product?
Yeah, so it's the Sphere 9 product. So that product is available in Europe now. We will have the results of the US IDE trial coming up at HRS in May. So that's the Sphere 9 catheter. We also have a second platform called Sphere 360, which we just released some first-in-human results at ERA, and those results were excellent, and we're really excited about the future of that technology, and we'll begin a IDE trial coming up with that catheter as well.
So how does your portfolio align around these multiple pulse field ablation tools? Are they going to be complementary? Are they going to be used ultimately when they're all in the market? I know they aren't right now, but how does the strategy play out for having a portfolio with so many, with three PFA devices, and I'm counting three, maybe there's more, maybe I'm missing one. How does this all play out?
Yeah, so there are really two pretty unique segments in the market. One is the PVI, or likely for earlier patients, and the other is a focal catheter. That's about 85% of the market. The PVI is 15% of the market. And so if you look at our PulseSelect catheter, that plays in that more 15% of the market space, and the Sphere 9 catheter plays in the focal space. So distinct, you know, markets that have been really out there for a very, very long time. So we believe that they're complementary products. Now, when you bring 360 into the space, that catheter is connected into the mapping and navigation system. And so that will be utilized with the Affera system. The PulseSelect catheter is available for use and is a more open platform that could be used on any mapping and navigation system. So today, we believe that there's a place for all of those technologies. I think the market will tell us, but what we're really proud of is the fact that we have technologies available across the entire scope of what an EP may want. And so you know, it's up to them to choose. So in the past, you know, we had one catheter with cryo, so our strategy was to really be more broad, and we believe we're there with products that we have on the market today.
So where does cryo fit into all of this? Does it get replaced by PFA? Is it still a useful energy source for this? What happens?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a number of, you know, projections out there in the marketplace about, you know, in 5 years, will PFA be 50% of the market? I think the market is yet to tell us the answer to that question. But if I look at cryo, you know, it has really, really strong efficacy results when, you know, we do redo ablations. We see the veins are silent in those patients. And so I think that technology has a place for the long term, just given its efficacy and safety over time.
So how is the market responding to the arrival of PFA? How are the electrophysiologists that you're dealing with? Is it something that they're hungry for, that they're sort of want to see it prove out a bit more before they embrace it? What's the reaction been?
Yeah, I think in any technology, you always have the early adopters and, you know, the late adopters. I will say with PFA, I think it's moving a bit more quickly to, you know, early adopters and then into the next phase. There is high enthusiasm for the PulseSelect catheter and the Affera catheters, by many, many physicians, I would say, are very excited to get started. And the results that we're seeing and the feedback that we're getting on these catheters has also been really, really strong. So we're proud of what we've done here.
So Rebecca, it's honestly getting hard to sort of keep track of all that's going on in this sector between the various companies that have programs. How does Medtronic sort of view the future of this sector with the various catheters and the players? And how does this sort of all play out?
So as I think about the future of this particular space, it's a broad space and it continues to grow. So we haven't seen a slowdown in the growth of the market in, you know, several years here, which I think is a really important point. The second piece is the catheters that we've developed here, both internally and through acquisition, really fit the entire space of what patients may want, whether that's first line therapy, whether that's persistent therapy. We have the tool set to make that happen. Now, certainly there will be continued study and evidence that's going to, you know, continue to progress the market. And like I said, I think our catheters are well positioned in any of the space across the EP portfolio.
Is there new innovations that are coming on? Is there going to be something already planned for post pulse field ablation that you're looking at, or is pulse field ablation for the time being the novel new technology we'll be hearing about?
Yeah, I think, you know, many of us, many companies, and, you know, of course, Medtronic for the longest year have been working on PFA, and I think the future really is now. And there's a lot of excitement and enthusiasm. Just like other technologies, we're going to continue to need to create clinical evidence and prove out which catheters, you know, are the best, and how do we do dosing strategies? How do we manage, you know, the opportunity for patients? But I think there are also, you know, like EP, the thing I mentioned at the outset, it's an exciting place to be. So what about AI, and what about being able to select patients through other means? versus just when you're in the lab. So I think there's more to come, but really there's a lot to talk about today with PFA.
Is there any opportunities for pulsed field ablation to be used in places other than the heart, or is it exclusively, is this its primary function, or can it be used to ablate tissue elsewhere in the body?
Yeah, pulsed field ablation has been used for years in some cancer treatments, so we're not the first to use PFA. I think there are plenty of opportunities for it to be used outside of the heart. I'm not the expert there, but I suspect that we'll see PFA used in many different ways in the future.
I just want to drill down one more on perhaps broadening the market. What patients today under cryo maybe weren't? They weren't advised to undergo ablation. Was it patients who perhaps were sicker, or what kept someone from going to electrophysiologist and being treated prior to PFA? And I'd like to understand how PFA potentially could change that.
Yeah, what I would say is the evidence around ablation in general has become much, much stronger for patients to get an ablation earlier. So our cryo first line study was a really important study that helped to drive guidelines to say ablation and cryo specifically should be done earlier. And so I think part of the transition to getting to more patients was done before PFA came along. But I think that's given physicians, cardiologists, patients even, much more confidence to get an ablation earlier. I think the other point here is safety. When you know you're not going to have a really difficult safety event, it's going to make patients much more open-minded to getting ablation earlier. And I think with the new technologies, we're seeing that coming forward as well.
Excellent. All right. Well, there's much happening. I'm sure we'll be touching base again. Rebecca Seidel, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Tom.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks again to Freudenberg Medical for sponsoring this episode of Device Talks Weekly. Thank you to our guests, Rebecca Seidel of Medtronic, Scott Nelson of FastWave, and Jeff Karp, of course, the author of Lit. If you want to get a copy of Lit, register for Device Talks Boston and use the code LIT25. You'll save money and you'll have the opportunity to receive a free copy. The first 10 folks to do that will receive a free copy of the book. But Jeff Karp will be at our opening reception on April 30th with a bunch of books to buy, and he'll be there to talk to you and talk about innovation and talk about biomedical research and talk about all the cool stuff. He's a highly sought after keynote. He's on TED Talks. He's got a lot of great achievements behind him, so a great person to connect with at Device Talks Boston. And Device Talks Boston, once again, is happening May 1st and 2nd at the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center. You definitely need to be there. Don't wait any longer. Giving you an opportunity to save money, giving you an opportunity to meet a great author, giving you an opportunity to maybe win a free book. I don't know what else I can do other than just say you're going to regret not being there. So please join us at Device Talks Boston. Regarding the podcast, please share this episode on social media. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss any of our future episodes of Device Talks Weekly, but our other great podcasts as well, including a couple of new ones that are coming out. So subscribe in any major podcast player to the Device Talks Podcast Network. And speaking of LinkedIn, please connect with me on LinkedIn, Tom Salemi, at Device Talks. You can also connect with Chris Newmarker, Editor-in-Chief at Mass Device, and Kayleen Brown, our Managing Editor at Device Talks. You can also follow Device Talks on LinkedIn. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. We've got a lot of great content coming out your way. Lots of great ways to receive it. So please be part of Device Talks. But most immediately, please register now for Device Talks Boston. Thank you to everyone who already has. Thank you again to everyone who's creating the great buzz about the event. It's very exciting. And thanks once more to Scott Nelson for the Jonathan Papelbon shout out. That was really cool. Anyway, all right, folks. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. We'll have another episode coming to you next week, and it'll be the final episode before our big event. And I really hope I get to see you in Boston. Take care, everybody.